Well, good morning, everyone. I'm really glad to be here, and I appreciate the invitation to join you all. Greetings from Albany, New York, and from Bethany Mennonite in Vermont. Just a little bit more about myself. Thank you for that wonderful introduction. I have a little bit of an eclectic Christian background. My dad was Sicilian, my mom was Irish, so growing up, I went to Catholic Church. And we didn't pray at home, except maybe grace before meals. We didn't read the Bible, but we were there every Sunday. And I was an altar server, so I learned a little bit about the inner workings of the Mass and all those different services they have throughout the year. But when I got to college, I wanted to start taking my faith a little more seriously. And I met up with some friends in a Bible study and ended up becoming part of an evangelical church in Saratoga Springs, just north of Albany. And it was there that I felt a call to ministry. I participated and led several short-term mission teams to Cambodia. And I ended up going to seminary, a distance program at Fuller Theological Seminary in Pasadena. But by the time I finished seminary, I did not fit in that denomination anymore. And they agreed with me. I'd been in this sort of ministry process, and by the time I was finishing up, I said, hey, this is the kind of thing I'd like to do. Is there room? And they said, no. So long. But what I did, one of the things I was able to connect with at seminary, one of my classmates was an Anabaptist church planter from San Diego, and he said, you should meet my friend Steve Chris. And Steve, before he became the conference minister, was traveling back and forth, and he still travels back and forth to Vermont from his home in Philly. And so Albany was a perfect place to stop and have lunch or dinner or stay over. And we talked a lot about the different things I was getting involved in and what ministry could look like. We talked at one point about planting a congregation, and that didn't really come together. But then eventually I said, well, what would licensing and ordination look like through the Mennonites? And he said, let me think about it. And Bethany seemed like a potential good fit. And so for a couple years, my wife and I would go and visit Bethany. Bethany's about 2 hours away from us, so we're not going every week. But we would go maybe once a quarter, and they formed a small discernment committee to get to know us. And we called it dating, right? Like, we got to know them a bit, and they got to know Leslie and I and the work we were doing in Albany. And after a few years, they went through a consensus process and said, we'd like to hold Joe's credentials for this work that he's doing in community organizing in the capital region of New York in particular, but really New York State. And so I work for an organization called the Labor Religion Coalition of New York State. We work with faith communities, labor unions, community groups on issues of social, racial, economic, environmental justice. And for the past several years, our primary area of work has been building up the New York State Poor People's Campaign, which is part of a national movement to revitalize and revive Martin Luther King Jr.'s last campaign. He was planning a Poor People's Campaign when he was assassinated in 1968. And so I'll talk about that a little bit more towards the end of my sermon. But this morning, the two things I really would like to share with you are related, a bit about how I've come to understand the role of the church and faith communities in social change. And related, I want to use the particular struggle that we find ourselves in around LGBTQ inclusion in the church as a sort of case study for us. My hope is that you'll be encouraged and strengthened in this critical witness and movement of justice. So let's get to the Bible, which is usually a good place to start. We're in the Gospel of Luke, chapter 20, but before we dive into that particular passage, one thing that's really helped me to understand and interpret the Bible is to recognize we should always situate a particular passage in the text as a whole. So where has the author been? What have they been indicating the whole text is going to be about? That way we can understand where they're going and help us interpret any particular passage. So it's not even Thanksgiving, but I want to talk about Christmas really briefly. The beginning of Luke includes the angel's announcement to Mary and her famous song, the Magnificat, which was referenced in our songs this morning. And she immediately understands this miraculous pregnancy to be a sign of God's faithfulness. And that faithfulness looks like the proud being scattered, the powerful brought down from their thrones, the lowly lifted up, the hungry filled with good things, and the rich are sent away empty. I think she's getting a little ahead of herself because none of that has happened yet. But that's how she understands the meaning of this child, Jesus, right? She writes a hit song about it. The angels show up to the shepherds and they say something similar. They're actually paraphrasing Roman imperial language of the time. They say Jesus is going to bring good news of great joy for all the people. And when the Romans conquered a new place, they would send out an announcement. It was said to be gospel, good news, the good news of Caesar, right? But with the Romans, their conquest and domination was only ever good news for some people, right? The Roman leaders, maybe some loyal collaborators. Everybody else suffered under their system. So when the angels say they're bringing good news for all the people, that's in direct contrast to Caesar's, quote, good news. Fast forward a little bit, Jesus has grown up, and he gives what's understood to be his first sermon, and he quotes from the prophet Isaiah. So here's what he says: "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me because he has anointed me to bring good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim release to the captives and recovery of sight to the blind, to set free those who are oppressed, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor." Now, I just want to say, partly because of my eclectic Christian background, I'm actually not very familiar with hymns at all, and we didn't coordinate on any of this, so a little bit of gentle providence and movement of the Spirit in aligning some of our hymns with this message this morning. But Jesus gets more specific, right? He says, good news to the poor. Now, I think there are two things that we tend to do with the Bible that limit our understanding of the text. I think these two tendencies are to individualize and to spiritualize any passage we read. Now, I'm not saying it's necessarily bad to read the Bible in an individual or spiritualizing way. That can be very encouraging to read it in a devotional way. But the problem comes if those are the only ways that we ever approach the text. And frankly, I think there are some very powerful social forces in the United States in 2022 that actually want to limit our understanding of the text in exactly those ways. So an alternative to individual readings would be collective or social readings. And an alternative to a spiritualizing reading would be concrete and material. So with that in mind, I'm going to go through this passage again. Keep in mind, a collective, social, and material, concrete understanding of these words. Good news to the poor, collectively. The poor as a class of people who materially do not have the necessary means to meet their needs, like food and shelter and healthcare. Nearly half of the people in our country, 140 million, are in poverty or just one emergency away. The way of Jesus needs to be good news to this group. Not in spiritual by and by after we die language, but concretely and now. Jesus says, release to the captives. The United States incarcerates more people by percentage of its population and by real numbers than any other nation on earth. Over 2 million people are currently incarcerated, millions more in some sort of supervised release, parole or probation. This is something about us today, right? Recovery of sight to the blind. The United States is the only developed country in the world that doesn't have some form of universal health care. Twice in the past year, I have been with people who have suffered a medical emergency and have said, please don't call an ambulance. I can't afford it. To set free those who are oppressed. I'm going to spend more time on this, but we should ask the question, who is oppressed in our society today? I think easily comes to mind racism and white supremacy, patriarchy, anti-Semitism, Islamophobia, undocumented immigrants, homophobia and transphobia. These are all different forms of oppression that are alive and well. And then to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor. Now, this is a reference to the biblical Jubilee, a Hebrew Bible instruction to the ancient Israelites that every 50 years all debts should be relieved, slaves set free, land returned to the original owners, a massive reset and restructuring of society to prevent the hoarding and accumulation of wealth. In our country in the past few months, we've been talking a lot about student debt, but there are so many other kinds. Our society is drowning in debt. What would it mean for those to disappear? Now, when I was in seminary and first learned about the Jubilee, To a T, the professors would always say, obviously, this couldn't happen today. And I'd say, wait, why is that obvious? Why not? Never really got a good answer. You start to see how a collective and a material reading of this text would have tremendous societal implications. And this is Jesus' MO, right? Like, his directly articulated purpose. This is what he says he has come here to do. So if we claim to be his followers, we need to take this seriously and actively work to confront these societal problems. Easy, right? No. I know it's much more complicated, but that's got to be our guiding orientation. So I want to pivot a little bit and talk about LGBTQ inclusion. I know that your congregation has taken a bold and courageous stand for justice, and I feel confident to speak on behalf of my congregation in Vermont. We are grateful to be part of this movement with you. But I also want to be clear, I am not cavalier in my position on this. In fact, years ago, I had very different ideas. I would have argued and supported exclusionary practices. And sometimes when discussing LGBTQ inclusion, certain accusations are thrown around at those of us who are advocating for inclusion. That we're not taking the Bible seriously, or that we're bringing some sort of outside assumptions and influences to our theology. Maybe that's the case for some people, but that is not the case for me. And I actually don't have much patience for those kinds of accusations, because I came to my current understanding through struggle with the text, within community, and with a deep desire and commitment to be faithful to Jesus. And further, in my time of wrestling with these questions and trying to sort this out, I hurt people I cared about. And I think it's important to note that while we collectively sort ourselves out about this in the conference, in the denomination, there is a cost that is being paid. There is a burden that is being carried by people who are not us. Now, growing up, I was heavily involved in the Boy Scouts. I earned the Eagle Scout rank. And when I was finishing high school in 2001, the Boy Scouts of America won a lawsuit in the Supreme Court affirming their right to exclude queer youth from the program and queer parents from serving as leaders. Now, like I said, I used to have very different ideas, and I agreed with that decision at the time. But I remember a lot of the news interviews with scout leaders from around the country, because this was big news. I remember thinking their arguments about how they justified their position didn't make much sense to me, because they were talking all sorts of rhetorical gymnastics to argue that gay scouts or gay leaders would be dangerous. But I knew the scouting policy, right? That there's a specific ratio that's actually required for any scouting event. There should always be two adults present, and then as the number of youth increases, you add additional adults, and they have a whole ratio and practice. And the idea is that provides safety and prevents abuse. So these scout leaders were arguing that queer scouts or leaders would be dangerous, but their own policy would prevent all the scenarios that they were raising as the dangerous possibilities of inclusion. So something else was going on. I couldn't figure it out at the time. It took me a few years. But I learned why they had to make these incoherent arguments that contradicted their own policies. And one of the largest organizational supports of the Boy Scouts is the Church of Latter-day Saints, the Mormons. And scouting was basically their official youth program. If the scouts began allowing queer youth and queer leaders in the program, the Mormon Church, which maintains an exclusionary policy towards LGBTQ folks, would leave, and they would take thousands and thousands of members, who knows how many dollars. So these scout leaders I saw on the news, it didn't actually matter what they thought about gay people. The institution of scouting required them to maintain the exclusion, even if it meant they had to tell transparent lies about their own policies and lies about how queer people are supposedly more dangerous than straight people. By the way, the first point of the scout law is trustworthy. The scout is trustworthy. Now, I could talk about Boy Scouts all day, but the reason I bring this up is that when we talk about arguments and fights about LGBTQ inclusion in the church, we are actually not talking about correct theology, right ideas, or the correct reading of the Bible. We are talking about concrete material conditions, power and authority, which is always connected to resources, whether that's in the conference, in the denomination, in the church at large, in our whole society. Now, this is a very roundabout way to get to our Bible text today, but I'm finally actually getting there. But this passage is a perfect example of how material conditions shape the conversation about ideas. So in our passage today, Jesus is questioned by the Sadducees. This is the first time they've shown up in Luke's gospel. And the Sadducees were the party of the aristocracy. As Luke helpfully points out, they did not believe in the resurrection. Now, they had actually very good and very biblical arguments for this belief. They knew the Torah very well, and the idea of a bodily resurrection is one that entered Judaism relatively late and was arguably imported from some surrounding cultures. But the Sadducees weren't concerned about the idea or the theology of the resurrection. All of Luke's early readers would have known instantly that the Sadducees are the party of rich aristocrats. And for rich aristocrats, inheritance is the primary way of building wealth and passing it on. So the Sadducees are trying to prove their position with this absurd argument, this case study, right? They're not concerned, though, about some sort of moral chaos or sexual chaos of what happens when everyone comes back, who she'll be married to. Because remember, women in this time were considered the property of their husband. These aristocrats were concerned about the economic chaos that a resurrection implies. They were saying there can't be a resurrection because that would complicate the question of who this woman belongs to. Aristocrats need really clear rules and laws about property, and the idea of a bodily resurrection would challenge and upend all of that. If everybody comes back, Jesus, who's going to have all the stuff? Right? That's what they're arguing. And that's partly why Jesus' answer is so confusing to us. He barely gives them the time of day. He effectively tells them, you don't know anything, you need to start over. And he refers back to Moses. He can't even argue with them on their terms because their terms are completely foreign to the gospel he's preaching. They're so invested in their power and wealth, they can't even perceive it. That's what he means when he says those who are considered worthy will neither marry nor be given in marriage. Because the whole system the Sadducees depended on, where wealth and power are accumulated, consolidated, and passed on through marriage, that doesn't have a place in God's kingdom at all. Mark's gospel tells this same story and frames it really starkly. Jesus tells them, they know neither the scriptures nor the power of God, and concludes flatly saying, you are quite wrong. Now, Jesus is patient and gracious with so many people in the gospels, but not here, not about this. And that's it. The Sadducees don't show up in the text again. Their whole purpose, the only reason Luke includes this story, is to completely discount and throw away that whole approach to living and operating in the world. Now, this passage, which is ostensibly about marriage, is not about marriage at all. It's about wealth and power. And you probably know this. The Bible says very little about homosexuality. There are arguably six verses that deal with it. They're not as clear about exclusion as many would like them to be. But on the other hand, the Bible has over 2,000 verses about poverty and the poor. The authors of the Bible are vastly more concerned with the economic structure of our society than they are with the genitalia of our sexual partners. The material results of a society that practices queer exclusion are clear. Prejudice, hatred, discrimination, poverty, sickness, suicide, death. And while there have been substantial positive steps in recent years, in many states in this country, queer people, and especially trans people, face discrimination in housing, employment, education, and healthcare. This year alone, there have been hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of anti-LGBTQ pieces of legislation introduced around the country. Next week, we'll likely start to see more. Queer and trans people are targeted with harassment, assault, and murder. Conversion therapy is legal in 30 states, despite the fact that it's known quackery. The attacks on queer and trans people are not new, but they are growing in viciousness and intensity. It's my understanding you experienced even a little bit of that here with online harassment. But it's happening every day in schools, at school board meetings, at libraries, talks of banning books, the talking heads on the news, fanning the flames of queer panic and groomers. Armed and violent militias like the Proud Boys are showing up to intimidate and assault queer and trans people and anyone who would support them. This is about so much more than marriage and who gets to be a leader in our congregation. And we have to ask why. Why such viciousness and such violence around this? So broadly speaking, throughout Jewish and Christian history, and many other histories, though not universally, the heterosexual marriage and family has been a basic family and economic structure of society. I'm speaking really broadly, but I think this is important. We want to understand marriage as this consensual covenant of love and support, but historically there's been much more to it than that. So that heterosexual marriage, the patriarchal family, has served multiple purposes throughout history. As we see in our Bible text, it structures economic relations and creates gender roles. And those gender roles exist for the purposes of two things: economic production and social reproduction. Hang with me on this. You didn't think you were going to like an academic class today on economics, but hang with me. It's looked different throughout history and in different systems, but there are broad consistencies. And in our system, under capitalism, you have economic production on one hand. That's the profit making. That's what workers do. They go and they work for a wage, and their boss makes more than they pay out in wages, right? And that's typically been done traditionally by men. But then on the other hand, you have social reproduction. And that's, how do we get new workers? That's raising, educating children, right? And that's typically been done by women and is unpaid historically. Hierarchies within the families are made and developed not because of some natural or God-given law, but based on the economic and material conditions of production. So the theology justifies the economic structure, not the other way around. In biblical times and through much of history, even in much of the world today, these family and gender-based hierarchies are such that women have been considered the property of men, first their fathers, then their husbands, and then children following after. And maybe, you know, it's so widespread that we think it's simply the normal way of being, but there are some downsides to this heterosexual family and marriage structure. Historically, it has enabled and obscured abuse and domestic violence and the denial of rights of women. And only recently, in some places, has marital rape finally been considered a crime, for example. Now, to be clear, I'm not opposed to marriage or saying it's universally bad. I am happily married, and I intend to stay that way. But there's more to it. There's more to this structure than just our individual relation to it, right? Our current understanding of consensual covenants of love and affection are relatively new in the history of this institution. And so if a structure, in this case, the heterosexual marriage structure, results in some kinds of harms and oppressions, we've got to examine who and what benefits from those. Who benefits from instituting hierarchies at the family level, where some people are treated as property, right? It's always the rulers, always the oppressors, always those rich aristocrats at the top of the system who depend on the continued extraction of wealth from those economic units. We don't have Sadducees today, but their legacy continues. I would argue that in other passages, when Jesus condemns adultery and divorce, he is not talking about marriage as we often naively understand it today, those consensual covenants of love. He's instead talking about the objectification and treatment of half of the population as property. And he's condemning those practices. He's doing it for the purpose of undermining the patriarchy and the hierarchies that divide poor and oppressed people from one another and prevent them from coming together for liberation. And this helps us see why there has been such resistance to full equality for women. When patriarchy is undermined, the economic structures that benefit the few at the top at the cost of the many are exposed, and then can be more effectively challenged. When we further introduce LGBTQ relations into this, the core claims of patriarchy, that there's this natural order with men at the top that limits and controls social reproduction, that conditions us to specific and exploitable gender roles, it completely falls apart. That's why there's such resistance both to women's equality and LGBTQ equality. Now, our friends in the United Methodist Church are tearing themselves apart over these same questions. A few years ago, Jeff Sessions, he's a United Methodist, he's a former U.S. Senator, former U.S. Attorney General, he was brought up on formal charges in their denomination because of his role in overseeing and implementing the detention of families and children at the U.S. border, the concentration camps for kids. At the time, everyone knew that this charges within the denomination was kind of a gimmick. a way to shame him publicly, but everybody knew it wasn't going to go anywhere in the institution, and it didn't. But just a few months later, the United Methodists held a very special general conference, an expensive event, because they're much bigger than the Mennonites, to discuss and debate plans to move forward on questions of LGBTQ inclusion. They left with an even more exclusionary policy, and their denomination is going to be splitting over this. These are the priorities. The literal caging of children is not a charge the institution would take seriously. But if you're queer and you want to serve in ministry, you're going to be brought up on charges and expelled. And this is not to point out the speck in our neighbor's eye. We've got a log in our own. Many, if not most, Mennonites and other Christians are in a nearly identical situation. What a morally and spiritually bankrupt witness. If we cannot speak on the side of human dignity here, how can anyone take us seriously on issues of anti-racism or poverty or immigrant rights or on behalf of the planet? Jesus says, if you are faithful in little things, you will be faithful in large ones, but if you are dishonest in little things, you won't be honest with greater responsibilities. Recognizing the wholeness of LGBTQ people is a little thing in the scope of the crises we face. Now, the social forces and the people most viciously opposed to queer rights are not confused about the interconnection of these issues. Think back to that terrifying day in Charlottesville, Virginia. The neo-Nazis and the fascists there know clearly and without hesitation that homophobia and transphobia are connected to white supremacy, are connected to anti-Semitism, are connected to Islamophobia, to oppression and exclusion of immigrants. Right? These oppressions aren't the same, they're not equal, but they are deeply connected. And these are more than just individualistic problems. It wasn't like all these neo-Nazis were saying, well, I just don't like immigrants, I don't like queer people. These are systemic oppressions, right? And if we think the Bible and our faith have something to say about this, we need to have a faith that can contend at these systemic levels. They are distinct, but they are connected, and they all serve the purpose of keeping poor and working class people divided from one another and fighting each other, rather than the exploiters at the top. We have to study and learn and understand the way these oppressions are connected. And this is what Dr. King was doing towards the end of his life when he organized the original Poor People's Campaign. It's what we're striving to do today. Amidst the successes of the Civil Rights Movement, the passage of the Voting Rights Act, the passage of the Civil Rights Act, the ending and dismantling of Jim Crow, King was beginning to see the limitations of integration. He would say, what good is it to sit at a lunch counter if you can't afford to buy a sandwich? He'd say, I'd come to believe we were integrating into a burning house. He was recognizing that poverty and violence in poor urban and rural communities was connected to the extreme imperialist violence of the Vietnam War. And he identified what he called the triplets of evil: racism, poverty, and militarism. And today, in our version of the campaign, we add ecological devastation. These massive systems of oppression are interconnected and have to be confronted in a holistic way. In our work in the Poor People's Campaign, we seek to unite poor and dispossessed of our society across every historic line of division, whether that's race, gender, sexuality, faith, immigration status, geography, because we know that the only way these oppressions can be ended is through this kind of unity. Not a surface unity where we all sit at a table and we just kind of tolerate one another, but a deep unity, a unity of solidarity, and a unity rooted in collective struggle. Towards the end of his life, Dr. King said, the prescription for the cure rests with the accurate diagnosis of the disease. And we understand that today, as in my organizing, we engage in collective study, that to confront these oppressions, we need to understand them accurately. We counter the politics of division with a politics of solidarity. We don't oppose racism or homophobia or transphobia just because it's a nice thing to do that we can do for other people, but because we understand that we are all bound up and harmed by these oppressions. We say white supremacy is the enemy of all poor people. Patriarchy, homophobia, transphobia, these are the enemies of all poor people. My good friend Wes McNeil is a queer and trans UCC minister. And years ago we were talking about this, and I said something like, I want to be a better ally in this. And they said to me, I don't need you to be an ally. I need you to understand how your freedom and your liberation are tied together with mine. Be Being an ally is too puny. It's too surface. It means I can check out and leave when things get too uncomfortable for me. We aren't all oppressed equally, but that's precisely the point, to keep us divided. We all suffer under these oppressions in different ways. My prayer for you and my commitment to you as a minister of the gospel in the Mosaic Conference and Mennonite Church USA is that we can walk together, grow in our understanding of these oppressions, and build the kind of deep unity and solidarity forged in struggle that can withstand the ongoing attacks. Our churches must be places of safety, sanctuary, and refuge for the oppressed, and places where we can organize, bases of operation where the dispossessed, those ground down by the oppressive systems we live under, can join together and take action together to end all oppression. That is good news for the poor.